Hi, this is James White from the Solution Series. Thanks so much for joining us here once again. And I am joined, as always, by Corey Lynn. And we are brought to you by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. Corey, always great to be with you.
It's great to be here.
It is indeed. And we are going to, it's going to be a fun show today. We are going to give our guest here a brief introduction. We are joined today by Fiona Price. For 40 years, Fiona was a serial entrepreneur, largely because she felt she was unemployable. She also wanted to make up her own experience every day, which proved to be extremely challenging, but ultimately rewarding. Armed with a psychology degree and an MBA, both of which were pretty useless, she says, she started out in the UK financial sector. This was a shock to her, as she is as a math phobic, and something she later discovered was common to many women in her generation. So in 1988, she set up a business to change this, helping women understand money management by de-jargonating it and empowering them to build their financial independence. Unexpectedly, she became a media spokesperson and a catalyst in the business women's networking movement, which was just starting at this time. During her time in the financial sector, she held several non-executive board positions and was listed in the top 100 of power and influence. She won a clutch of business awards, featured in many books on women entrepreneurs, and men mentored fellow businesswomen. Later on, in the early days of online video, Fiona set up several internet businesses. Then it was time to change, and she metamorphosized from city professional to semi-feral, living reclusively in Wales with her animals on an ancient farmstead. For the last couple of years, Fiona has been living on wheels, reinventing herself again, and gesturing her next project, the Earth Collective, a self-sufficient eco-community she is planning to establish in Ireland. Sport has played a large part in Fiona's life too, having competed at international level in both rowing and equestrian endurance. Alongside all of this, she says she has been on a lifelong spiritual quest to understand herself, her crazy life, and the equally crazy world around her. Fiona Price, thanks so much for joining us here on the Solution Series.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, Corey.
I'm really looking forward to this one. This is going to be fun. So you just have such a fascinating life, and you're kind of living my dream right now, to be honest. So you have so many great insights and tips, and you also, I don't know, did we include this in the bio there? You also authored the book, The Ultimate Relationship, The One with Yourself. Yeah. And I want to talk about that and how that kind of led you into the traveling by RV, which we actually did an episode on RVing, which mostly focused on kind of doing it in the US, but gave people all over different tips. So for you, it's interesting because in the UK, it's a very trickier thing to not only find an RV, a manufacturer, but then you're limited with where you can stay. And you have some great tips for people on protection against EMF and electric fields and tools that not only they could use with RVing, which is really cool, but in their own homes. And then, of course, now you're in Ireland and you're looking to do this community with Earthships, which I've been looking at Earthships forever. They're so cool. So we're kind of getting into building the relationship with yourself and the higher consciousness and where I think we kind of all need to move into, mixed in with the RVing and the community you're looking to do. So let's start out with your book and building a relationship with oneself and the importance of that.
Yeah, well, I did the book last year while I was traveling. It had been sort of bugging me for a long time that I had so many things that I discovered when I was packing up to sell my house. All of this information, these notebooks, this stuff I'd written over many years, and it was all going to go on the bonfire. But I actually decided I would have to read it for one last time. And when I read it, I thought, oh my goodness, there's no way I can put this on the bonfire. I've got to put it into a book and get it out there, because stuff that was so life-changing for me, maybe one or two things would help other people as they read the book as well. And then it did go on the bonfire in the end. So that was where the book started. And I think now, actually, having published it last year, it's really timely because, so many people are looking around and saying, the world's broken. You know, everything's dysfunctional. We can't trust authority anymore. We can't trust in the systems anymore. And we have to start taking more responsibility for ourselves. And where that starts is this relationship with you. And I suppose that's been my focus forever. I mean, really, since I was in my late teens, I was in Australia between school and university, and in the middle of the desert, actually at Ayers Rock, which, you know, the indigenous term is Uluru, I met a wise woman who said to me, "You are a sensitive." And I had no idea what she meant. I mean, other than sort of sensitive to the all that there is. And it really piqued my interest, and it started a lifelong quest to understand the bigger picture. So then going back, let's go back to myself, because I've written about my experience, and, you know, it's personal. Everyone has their own version of this sort of thing, I guess, if they're minded to explore it. But mine really started from wanting to always be the best that I could in everything that I did. I mean, I was probably born like it, and my family culture reinforced it. And my early proving ground was actually rowing, because I shouldn't have been any good. I was far too small. But I maximized my fitness and my technique was very good. And then I used visualization to make up for my lack of stature. And there was no sports psychology at that time. We're talking the 1970s. And I remember also saying to myself when I was training, twice the benefit. I'm going to get twice the benefit in fitness from this session. And that eventually went up to four times the benefit, because that was as much as I could get my head around. But in the end, that use of the power of thought, mind over matter, eventually led me to competing in the Commonwealth Games. So, you know, I knew that thought was powerful, very powerful. And later, I used the same idea in communicating with my animals, especially my horses, telepathically. I could actually train my horses using literally pictures. I would say their name to get their attention, and then I would show them the picture as if they were seeing the movement I wanted them to do. Or, you know, when they got stressed going in the trailer to go to a competition, I would be able to show them what it looked like when they got there. If they'd been there before, that they would recognize it. And if they didn't, I would show them out of their eyes what activity they were going to do, dressage, jumping, whatever. And they would go, and then the projectile pooing would stop and they'd get onto the trailer and be very happy, or be able to do that move I was trying to explain to them when I was riding them much easier. So the power of thought was something I learned in very, very practical ways. And in the end, I then started to use that as part of a self-healing program as well. And I know you've had horses, Corey, so maybe you've had some experience of that as well.
I have.
So shall I carry on and tell you a bit about the healing
side?
Yeah.
I mean, I could go on and on about my horses, but you have so much good stuff to share.
I was expecting you to, Corey. I was expecting you to go on and on about. That's why I was quiet. I thought you were going to go on and on about your horses.
No, I had this one experience where I would do that too. I would speak with them telepathically, and I'd visualize everything, and I didn't even need the lead. You know, it would just follow side by side, and I'd say, okay, well, we're going to just do like a little canter in a circle here, and I'd be on the ground doing groundwork and just communicating telepathically with no lunge lead, no nothing. And
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Very cool.
Exactly. Actually, I also discovered a lot about the power of thought in business, and I wanted to mention that before we talk about healing. So business afterwards became my sort of working laboratory for testing out all manner of things. I had a crazy life. It was perpetual motion. I didn't even have time to go to the loo in the day. You know, it was that mad. So I would use all sorts of visualization to, for instance, make sure that the tasks fitted, or rather the time fitted the tasks. So, you know, 12, 14 meetings during the day with half an hour between one of them to write an article for somebody. And I had vision, and I, before I even got out of the house in the morning, in fact, before I got out of bed, I would visualize everything working, tickety-boo, getting everything done that I needed to do, and it all being great. And invariably it was. And then also because I lived out of London, I was commuting, I had very little sleep. I mean, I survived for about 20 years on maybe 5 hours sleep a night. But I would imagine before I went to bed at night that I would have the perfect sleep and rejuvenation in the time available. And I would tell myself that. And I fully functioned all of those years. I was never ill. I was able to be effective in what I was doing. So I used business. Business was a fantastic opportunity. And really, the sport had sort of given me the heads up that I could apply the same, the power of thought in that I'd used through visualization in my athletic career to business. So I just found it really exciting. And the more I managed to do, the more I was hooked, really, and just wanted to explore even further. And I think it's like anything, when you want to develop a new skill, you have to practice, and you have to develop a new habit of being. So, yeah, I mean, healing was another fantastic
Can I interject for a
classroom.
second, Fiona, before you go on? You talk about sports, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but you probably are familiar with this. There was a study that was done with basketball players shooting free throws, and there was one group actually physically did the free throws and they practiced, and the other group sat and just visualized making free throws. That was their exercise. They didn't physically do it. They just mentally did it, essentially. And when it came down to actually doing the free throws, it was remarkable how well the group that just visualized the free throws did compared to the group that actually physically did it. So, that was just I don't know exactly the conclusion they reached it, but it did show the power of visualization. It's a very, very powerful thing.
It's extremely powerful, and you can use visualization to play out all of the different possible scenarios that might actually happen. So when I was rowing, for instance, every time you do a race, it's going to hurt because you go through the pain barrier every single time. So, you have to be able to have on automatic pilot the different race strategies. You have to have visualized absolutely everything. Where will you put in a burst of speed? What will happen if somebody comes back at you? How will you manage that? So you have to be on automatic pilot, having done of all of these role plays in your mind. And then riding cross country, if you're, jumping big fences cross country, you've got all manner of things that could go wrong. You've got to know the terrain. You've got to get your line exactly right. Otherwise, you could have make a mistake. It's a big fixed fence. You'd invariably have a fall. So I would sort of think through absolutely everything and what would happen if. And then, as I say, you're in automatic pilot, and it makes an absolutely massive difference. Or you see yourself coming through the finish, happy, safe. You and your horse are safe. So yeah, I mean, I just know from my own personal experience, I should never have been able to be as good as I was at rowing, but it was really the sort of power of thought that was my sort of secret, my secret ingredient.
Which I think is incredibly important right now with where we're at with everything, because I feel like, and I'm at fault too, because here I am reporting on all of this, but there's this perpetual madness, this cycle of regurgitation of all this negative news and the constant news cycles. And whereas we do, it's important that we're aware of what's going on and what this reality is and what their, the attempts are with these agendas on surveillance and enslavement. It's more important, in my opinion, that for balance and for the future, that we manifest positive outcomes, that we think about them, we talk about them, we plan them, we carry out the actions, and visualization and thought and words are incredibly, incredibly important in all of this right now.
Yeah, I want to lead up to my process, my actual process for manifesting a project by dealing with these individual elements now, but leading up to exactly that point. And I think also the other thing I would say about the power of thought, you have to be very careful what you think, because thought has a cause and effect relationship with the world around us. We know that. It's science now. And so if you are thinking negative thoughts about yourself or about situations or about people, and those thoughts are strong enough, that becomes your focal point in the sort of well-known law of attraction. That's your point of attraction, and you will attract to yourself what you're focused on, whether you want it or not. So actually, one of the really, really important things in starting to be the master of your own reality and create the life and the health and the everything that you want is that you have to unpick all of the programming that you've gained through all of your lifetime, through your family, your friends, through society, through your education. And actually, one of the easiest times at which you can start to unpick this negative thought patterning is usually when you're challenged or when you're in a situation of conflict, because that creates your knee-jerk reaction in terms of behavior and in terms of thought. So actually, it is really a lifelong endeavor to start to narrate to yourself how you think and why you think that, and then to start to say, well, does that serve me? Has that been creating repeating patterns in my life, the wrong relationships, the wrong jobs, the wrong situations of various sorts? And how do I change that? And actually, one of the fantastic ways of changing that, of sort of relaunching your new intentions, is using affirmations. I still use affirmations today. I've used them all of my life. They are super powerful. So, yeah, I mean, we absolutely need now to lift off the negativity of the knowledge of where we're at in the world today. And now is really, really the time to start to create this new world that we all want to live in, or that a number of us want to live in at any rate, because it's got to happen from the ground up. The top is too damaged for the change to come from the top down. So it's about all of us developing this relationship with ourselves in order that we can become manifestors in our own life and in groups of people that want to do similar things, whatever those things are, and actually start to rebuild the world.
How much of a role do you think the media plays in the negativity? I got a feeling, I really do. I got a feeling that if everybody would turn off their phones and their televisions and everything for 2 weeks, I think we could probably repair some hate that's been going on for a long time. I think it's fueled. And here, you know, like Corey said, I'm just as guilty as everybody else. I mean, I do a radio show and I'm not the doom and gloom kind of guy. I try to talk about solutions kind of like we do here. But the fact is, if you turn on any social media appliance, you're going to get bombarded with negativity. It's just almost impossible to avoid it. So you almost have to turn that off.
The mainstream is corrupt. We know that it's been compromised. Personally, I stopped watching the news about 20 years ago or more, and I haven't had a TV for at least 20 or 30 years. So, and I don't do social media and I don't use my phone, but we're going to come on to that with devices and, you know, configuration of the RV in a bit. But no, I think you have to be very, very selective. I mean, that said, I am investigating, you know, our life and times every day, probably several hours worth while I'm doing other things, listening to podcasts and so on. But I choose the platforms that I trust, like Solari, like James Corbett and various others. I have sort of half a dozen, and those are my go-to sources. And I know that those sources are well researched, and I know that they're going to give me proper information from which I can make my own decisions about my life, and also be able to disseminate information to other people who don't have time to do research. I can share what I learn by passing that on because I'm using independent, uncompromised sources. So I think you're right, absolutely. And it's about being terribly selective.
Well, I want to get into the RV part of this because there's like I said, we did the one episode and it was kind of focused on the US, and I want to hear what it's like, because I know you and I already had a conversation about this and it's fascinating what you went through to get your RV and how you structured it, which I absolutely love the way you designed it. Okay. It's so functional, you know, and a lot of people think they can't live in small spaces, but if it's functional and you think about like where you actually spend your time when you are indoors, I think people would be surprised. I actually find it cozy and it's so much less to take care of and clean. So it frees up a lot of time.
Yeah. So, okay. So you don't want to talk about manifestation, or you want to come back to that?
Oh no, I want to come back to that. I do. I want to come back to that.
Okay. We'll talk coffee.
Yeah. After the RV, we'll get into the community and kind of work off it from the community, I think.
Okay. All right. I was sort of pretty shocked to find myself making this move and living on wheels. But I have reinvented myself a number of times, and I think it's in my nature to be fairly extreme. So I went from city professional to semi-feral and had this sort of 7 or 8 years in the middle of nowhere with my animals and my land, and really rewilding my soul. And part of that process was connecting with nature in a way that I hadn't done before. I'd always loved being outside, and my sport was always outside. But you don't really connect with nature when you're busy doing something else outside. And when I moved to the middle of Wales, I was in a microclimate of absolutely dire weather. And it was of the utmost importance that I really tuned in to understand when it was safe to turn the horses out, when I couldn't leave the property, when the bad weather was coming in, when I had to go and get provisions, and so on and so forth. And so that was a connection with nature that helped me to second guess what was coming, that was more accurate than turning on the weather forecast, to be honest. So I think that connection with nature started to, well, there were a number of things. There was the connection with nature. There was the financial reality of coming out of the corporate world and actually finding that money was tight after having, you know, big salaries when I was in London for 20 years, and wanting to reduce my bills. There was the whole thing about trying to be self-sufficient, and you can't be sufficiently, you know, low on bills or self-sufficient when you're living in a 15th century property. But I had a wood burner, I had biomass, I had my own water, a borehole, I had some solar panels, and various own drainage, for instance. So I'd done a certain amount, and I'm going around the houses here for a reason, so bear with me. And also, I think I knew what was going on in the world and wanted to get out of dependence on the system. So all of that led me to thinking, how am I going to live? Where am I going to live? And actually, I wanted to live abroad. I'd sort of done with the UK. I wanted a really clean start. And I felt it was easier to reinvent myself in a new environment. Anyway, when the madness kicked off and I couldn't travel abroad without hassle, and I didn't do any of the diktats at all, ever, I thought, well, what do I do now? I'm stuck in the UK for I don't know how long, and I don't want to buy or build in the UK because I'm not staying here. What do I do now? So I thought the unthinkable, and I thought, okay, it's got to be wheels. And I hadn't seen the UK. I'd always been too busy. So I thought, this is an opportunity to get some wheels and actually go travel. So I looked around. I didn't like anything I saw because I'd never really fancied caravanning, and it was all very dull. And I came across the one and only firm in the UK that make RVs. Now, they're not RVs as you know them in the States, because yours are sort of supersized. Mine's pretty supersized. And in the UK, nobody's even seen RVs. And so I always have a queue of people everywhere I go wanting a tour. But I thought, OK, I can do that. That space is the maximum space that I can tow and pitch. And it was nip and tuck in the UK, and it's even more nip and tuck in Ireland. And it was the maximum size that I could get onto campsites with a limited option.
It looks very nice. Really. It looks very nice. Called Freedom, right? I just had it on the screen.
Yeah.
It's very nice.
It's called the Freedom.
How long is that one?
That is 8.5 meters long, unhitched, and it's 12.5 meters when it's hitched. And it's 2.3 meters with a slide out in, and the slide out adds another 1 meter. So I thought I would do that now. I've got lots. Do you want me to sort of talk through the things about the design and all the rest of it that were really important? And that
I do. I think it is important to anyone jumping into this trying to determine their space. But then the way you went about it with the electric fields, I think is phenomenal.
Yeah. Okay, so I think it's really important. I bought mine from scratch. That meant it was built from scratch, and I had the opportunity to really input into the design. So the space I had was fixed in terms of the living area, the bathroom, the bedroom, but everything else was up for grabs. And having designed office spaces, having designed a horse box, having designed my own house a number of times over, it's not a big deal to think through exactly how you want your space to be. And in a tiny space, it really takes a lot of thinking and detail, even down to the shelving and the whole lot. You know, you need to know where everything is. It needs to be easily accessible. Anyway, so I started from the bare infrastructure, and I said, right, what's really important to me is the way that it's is the minimizing of electrical, magnetic, and radio frequency fields. So I'd done a lot of research into the whole EMF thing. I knew that it was a big deal. I'd already had experience affecting my health in my previous property, and I'd worked out what I could do in the 15th century farmhouse. So with the unit, I had the wiring done for all of the plugs on a direct wired basis. So everything goes to a socket. It isn't in a circuit. So normally you have everything on a circuit, but in such a small space, you can never get away from that circuit. You're sitting right in the center of it the whole time. So I managed to find somebody that knew a bit about it. Now, I think in the States, you've got building biologists who know a lot about this subject, and we don't have them in the UK, not really. So that was one thing that was really important. And then having as much of the electrics in the control panels outside in the lockers as possible. And all of the lockers, there's one inside and several outside that have electrics in, are lined with a thin layer of aluminium. So I create a sort of space where it's difficult for the electrical field to come out of those boxes, really, and that minimizes what I have to live with.
Does that kind of create a Faraday cage almost kind of secondarily as well, kind of? Like
Yeah, sort of. And none of the stuff that's in the cabinets that are lined needs to have access to 4G, for instance, or to connectivity. It's just like connections, fuses, batteries, and that sort of thing. So yeah, they're all in boxes that are lined. Then what else? No sockets in the bedroom. I didn't want any sockets in the bedroom at all. So I didn't want any wiring in there, basically. I wanted a washing machine. That was really important. A girl's best friend and all that. And I wanted drying areas. So there are various cupboards around the place that have got hot pipes running through them. And I've put sort of hanging places and stuff so I can dry nearly everything easily inside that comes out of my washing machine. Then I wanted organic furniture, and the manufacturer couldn't do that for me. And so I went and got an organic sofa made by a furniture manufacturer, which means it's freestanding. It's strapped in at the back of the sofa, but it also means it's a proper sofa and it's much more comfortable. So I also had an organic mattress made. The manufacturer gave me a template for the bed, and I went and got a beautiful latex and wool mattress made. So I wasn't going to be lying on anything that had fire retardants in, for instance. So that was all really important. Something else to bear in mind is the payload, and then also the distribution of weight in the unit with the stuff that you're having built in. And I found out that if I had rear airbags put into the back of my Merc truck that I tow with, that gave me an extra 1,000 kilos of payload. So that was actually a handy thing to do. Then there is power and heat and cooking and backups. So power is electric by and large for the combi boiler. So the combi boiler does my heating and my hot water, and it's got underfloor heating, and it's on a thermostat, so I can just set the temperature and it will do its thing. And the backup is gas. So if there's a problem, then I can use gas, but I try not to because I keep that for cooking. And actually, it's got a nozzle attachment on the outside, so I can just go to a pump and fill up rather than having to replace the canisters. I did have four solar panels put on the roof, and I think two or three lithium-ion batteries. But because I wanted to minimize the electrical fields, I didn't have an inverter, because an inverter actually has a really big electrical field. And so what that means is that if I'm off grid, if I don't have a hookup, I can't use my solar power that's stored in the batteries for anything that's on 240 volts. So for big items, I can only use it for my computer, for charging, for the lights, and so on. But that was a compromise that I was prepared to make. Then no chemicals. I didn't want any chemicals. So that leads you to, well, what toilet do you have? And I found, when I researched, there are a few really interesting options on the market now. You can have an incinerator loo. Have you heard of that, Corey? Incinerator loo?
I just recently heard of it, and I was going to look into that. How does that work exactly?
Yeah, well, it just incinerate everything that goes into the loo. It takes about 30 or 40 seconds to build up a head of steam in terms of heat. And what you end up with is a tiny amount of ash, like a thimble full of ash. So you get have a little tray and you can just empty the ash. But I didn't go for that because it actually would take quite a lot of power to run the incinerator. And I was thinking, I was trying to work out if I'm on in the UK a 10 amp or a 16 amp pitch. We don't have sort of massive 35 amp pitches like you do in the States. Then how much does everything take? In Ireland, it's even worse. You only have 6 amp in some places. I can't even run my heating on 6 amps, but on 10 amps, I can run my heating, but I can't boil a kettle as well. So I have to turn my heating off to boil the kettle. But normally in the UK, it's 16 amps. So it's really important to work out how much power does everything take and the standing things that have to run all the time. So I didn't opt for the incinerator loo, but I opted for something else called a separat loo, which is Norwegian. And so you have your pee basically in one compartment and your solids in another. You can put the empty the pee canister every 3 days or something, and you can put that down where the grey waste goes, and then you can compost these solids. So it was a compromise. It was something that took almost no power because it has a little fan that runs over it to make sure it doesn't smell. And so that sort of ticked the box with no chemicals, and it ticked the box with low power, which I thought was quite a neat solution.
May I ask
That was pretty cool.
how long did you? It sounds like this is no small time operation. Like you spent probably hours and days researching this stuff. And the stuff that you know just off the top of your head, it's like, wow, for crying out loud, that'd take a lot of research to figure that stuff out.
Yeah, no, honestly, seriously, it took a lot. But I miss detail, and when I get into a project, I like to really go to town on it. But actually, not as long as you would think. I guess by the time I saw the unit, and then decided to go ahead pretty much straight away. And the design process, so I worked very carefully, very closely with the designer, and was researching all this stuff along the way, probably took 2 months, and then it took maybe 2 months to build it. So it was really only about 4 months from the time I made the decision to actually getting it.
That's not too
But
bad.
anyway, yeah, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. So do you want to go on to to devices? Should we go on to
Oh
devices?
yeah, the devices are fun stuff.
All
And some
right.
of these can be used in homes too.
Oh,
So,
it's all for homes. It's
yeah.
all for homes as well. Right. Oh, one thing I forgot to say was that best laid plans and all that. There was something that I found shocking that I didn't know about, and that is that the way that these units are made, everything is glued. Everything. So when you get it and you get that new smell is actually off-gassing of VO2s. So your forever chemicals are off-gassing, and it is highly toxic, and it takes 3 to 6 months for the smell to go. I had no idea. I didn't that I missed that completely. And so I bought an air purifier, which was had special filters in it for VO2s, and so I had that on all the time basically. So that would be important to mitigate against with an air purifier. Right, okay, devices, here we go. So I knew, as I say, I knew all about the EMF stuff, and I had to do a lot more research for this, but I at least had a starting position. So I use, do you want me to show it, Tori, the light tower?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay, here we go. This is one of the devices. It is it's on a tower, but actually it's that, which is stainless steel with a plasma coating. And the reason it's on a tower in the unit is because this is an aerial here, and this gives it a range of 25 feet in every direction. Whereas if I wear it on my person, I put it in a pouch when I'm out and about, or I'm cycling, because I'm on an electric bike, so I'm sitting on a battery in an electrical field on the motor. So I take that with me, putting it in a pouch, and then that's like a pendant. It's just protecting you as a person. But in the space, The aerial gives it this range, which means it covers me when I'm outside and when I'm anywhere in the unit. So whatever anyone else has got on their unit next to me, or the site has got Wi-Fi, I'm protected with this unit. It has fantastic science behind it. And what it does is it basically structures the incoherent electrical fields that are all around you. So all the stuff that comes off, routers and fridges and washing machines and wiring that is harmful to you is structured by this device so that it basically neutralizes the harmful effects. But what it also does is it then entrains the cellular structure of your biology to do the same thing. So it has health benefits like increasing the iron levels in the blood and oxygenation and biophotons, which are vital to rejuvenation. And it builds immunity and it improves sleep. And you can also stand all of your drinks on it after you've made them, or you can stand the food you're preparing and washing before you cook it, and it will do the same to those things as
Can you
well.
buy that somewhere? Did you just make that
Yeah,
yourself?
no, God, no. This is 35 years of research that comes from America, in fact. I've given Tori a link for that, so
Oh,
you can have
great.
that if,
Excellent. I probably have it. I have it in the notes.
yeah.
Fantastic.
So that is amazing. But also, then there was the question of what do you do about water? Because, while I had water in a borehole at my farmstead, you're out and about and there's fluoride in water and there's chlorine in water and there are the nanoparticles that are coming down from the sky and from all the spraying in the sky. So I looked into, all manner of filters, including those that would take out the nanoparticles. And that could have worked, but it had to be, I didn't have the space in an outside locker to put three or four filters that I needed, having done all this research. And then I discovered they can't get below zero, so they cannot live outside. So I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do now? So anyway, I came across this fantastic tech, which is quantum physics. It's called implosion technology. And I have various devices on me. I think this is an implosion device, for instance. So it has water. And it has crystals. The water is structured. So, this whole thing about structured water is really, really important. We have in our bodies about 20%, I understand, that is structured water, which means it has coherence. It is different to the rest of the water. And it's the same idea as the spas, the health spas in the world that are meant to be so healing. It's structured water. So this device and what I have on my in pipe coming into the unit, so the in pipe before the water splits and goes in different directions, I have a massive coil that has the same structured water and crystals in it. It's beautiful, it's copper and it's triangular and it just spirals down and it's tied with cable ties onto the in pipe. And there is a sort of quantum transfer of the structure of the water in that onto the water that comes through the in-pipe going into the unit, which means that it structures everything, the shower water as well as the drinking water. It improves the taste. I mean, something's happening when the taste is completely different. You can taste the water without that, just out of the tap on a pitch on a campsite, and it's revolting. And you can taste it once it's come through once it's had contact with the implosion device, and it's completely different. So there's a lot of science behind that as well. I'm not interested in stuff that is hearsay. I'm interested in stuff that's got
This is
evidence
fascinating.
behind
This is
it.
fascinating stuff that you're talking about here. And you know what that reminds you of? There's got to be something with frequencies and resonance, because have you ever seen those videos where they put sand on top of a speaker and they turn on music and it all goes into an exact geometric pattern and everything? So there's so much, there's like more like unseen stuff. I think it's like stuff
Oh,
that you just
yeah,
can't see and that
acoustics
go,
and vibration.
that, all that. Have you seen that, haven't you, Corey, where it all just like
Oh, yeah.
turns into like a perfect form or like a perfect flower or something? Amazing stuff.
Well,
There's so much more we don't know.
yeah, oh, absolutely. But actually, we do know it's just been kept from us. I mean, this is hard science in certain circles. And Tesla, 100 years ago, said if you want to understand the world, think in terms of frequency, vibration, and whatever light frequency and vibration, I think it was, or something similar. So actually, this is it's just It's just unusual because we're not given access to this sort of science. But anyway, I again have given the link for the implosion tech. And
And
so
we'll
people.
have those under the commentary so people can
Yes, we
access
will.
that
We
one.
will.
Okay, so the third thing, which is really important, is earthing in terms of devices, especially when you're living up off the ground. And so, and I had done a number of these things. I'd had this device actually. I'd known about it before, and I had tried it on my house before I'd even moved. But then I sort of went back thinking, oh well, maybe I need to be belt and braces and have the different filters, and hence going down that route and then coming back to it. But earthing, I had on my bed at the previous place, but I have here. So I have a sheet on my bed. I have a pad under my keyboard, so my wrists are on it the whole time, and I have one on the seat of my car. So the car connects to the chassis and it earths through the chassis. The one on my desk connects to the chassis of the unit and will earth that way. And then for the bed, only in case there's lightning, really. Well, no, actually, if there's lightning, I probably wouldn't use it because I tend to put a lead out of the window and have a stake in the ground. So I actually earth into the ground itself with the one that I sleep on. So yeah, I tried to find out, well, so what happens if there's lightning? And I couldn't get an answer, not even from the manufacturer. So I just don't use it if there's lightning.
And what is this device now when you're saying earthing? So what is it?
Earthing, right, earthing. So basically, all right, sorry, I should have explained. If you, in the normal run of things, if you took your shoes off and you stood on the earth for 20 minutes a day, or you wandered around barefoot for 20 minutes a day, you would earth. So that would be a process of getting rid of all the static that accrues. This is my understanding of it. The static that accrues in our energy field during the day from one reason and another, including all of the wiring and stuff. So that is what earthing does. It will take it out of your body into the earth and ground it. Yeah, so in the absence of wandering around barefoot, what else do you do? And there's been, again, a lot of science behind it and hugely helpful with people that have certain conditions and illnesses and low energy and so on. So without being barefoot, these are the things that I do in order to make sure that I'm not holding static in my energy field. I probably wouldn't be with all the devices I've got, but I've gone a bit overboard with devices, I'm afraid.
Hey, Corey,
But
do you remember we had Nancy O'Brien on, and she had
yeah.
said take aluminum foil and pull out a strip of aluminum foil and sand it on it with your bare feet if you don't have 20 minutes to stand on the ground. And she was like a former homeopathic physician, I think. But she said if you stand on that aluminum foil for, I think, while you're brushing your teeth, it'll discharge a lot of that what you're talking about into that aluminum foil. But I've heard the earth thing as well, and I would prefer to do the earth thing, to be honest with you, because then you kind of, at least you kind of in touch with nature in that sense, I guess, and mildly. Sorry, Corey, to cut you off.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, now with all these devices, how do you feel?
Yeah, great. Great. I mean, I don't know. I never have a problem with energy. I never get sick. I haven't had anything wrong with me for 40 years. I just, but that's been part of my whole outlook on life. And what we didn't talk about health before was this whole using the power of thought to talk to the cells of your body. So I do everything that I can to minimize the toxicity, the crazy toxicity that's in our skies, in our air, in our water, in our food, in our environments, in our clothes, in everything. So I do all the practical things. I also talk to the cells of my body, and the self-healing and stuff is related to that. And so I would do a an affirmation every day where I say something like, my biology is 100% balanced, and my physics, and my chemistry, and my subtle bodies, which is my mental, my astral, my etheric bodies. So I actually talk all the time to the cells of my body, because if you don't become the boss of your body, it does its best, but that isn't always good enough. And so I want to be in charge of my body, and I talk to my cellular structure and I tell it what to do when I amputated my finger, and when my horse severed an artery in his knee. And I've done injuries, I haven't done illness, but I've done plenty of injuries to practice using the power of thought to heal myself. And actually, that isn't just woo-woo anymore. That is proven in science, that consciousness affects our biology. That is proven. So yeah, I feel great. I always have good energy. You know, I'm very aware of when my balance goes and what to do about it. I use, I've used for 40 years or so a pendulum. So I use this to put my instinct on the end of a piece of string where I can see it, which is actually much easier than trying to sense where it is in your body. And I use that for food, what I should eat. I competed international level equestrian endurance, as you said, in the intro, and I did all of the horses' food, nutrition, and my own and our fitness training by dowsing. So the combination of research and finding the right questions to ask and gaining information and then dowsing and then doing more research and then doing more dowsing was a process I used to get to the pithy essence of what today, what in a week's time, what in preparation for a competition. And, you know, I've always found it to be incredibly helpful and time saving. So yeah, I do all of these things, but I also take responsibility for using my innate assets as well as devices and gadgets.
Right. Now, another device you have is the meter, right?
Yeah.
And so you go around and, oh, and campsites. Just yeah. Let people know in the UK, you know, how is there, are there any easy ways to find places to stay there when they're searching to camp out there? Because I know you said it's kind of tricky finding places, but also the meter, because I know you said at one point yeah. you came into a campground and there was like a 5G tower right there.
Yeah, I can't access it right now because my light is sitting in front of the meter, but I have a tri-field Gauss meter. That's G-A-U-S-S. It's an American one. And it measures the magnetic, the electrical, and the radio frequencies anywhere. So I find it incredibly helpful because in the design and while we were doing things with the unit, I was able to go around with the meter and actually test what we were doing to check that it did actually minimize the fields. But then when I go to a campsite, although I have all of the gadgets, normally, you know, I know I'm all fine and it's not a problem if there is a transformer on an electrical post nearby or there's a wire going over the top. But I did go to one site and with best planning and intentions and questions asked of the campsite before I went, I got there and found there was a 5G mast on the campsite. And I put my meter on it and it just went off the scale. And I thought, you know, even with all my devices, I would be so stressed actually knowing that that was there oozing all of this stuff. I cannot stay. So I think it is really important and it helps you to get your strategy right. And actually, I've probably used it for family and friends more than I've used it for myself because, you know, you talk about these things and people are very reluctant to take it on board because electrical fields and other fields are invisible. And so for most people, that means therefore they don't exist and therefore they're not harmful. Wrong. And if you can prove it with a meter and you show someone what their router is doing or whatever in their house, then that actually is indisputable. You know, and actually, sorry.
No, it's okay. No, please yeah. continue.
No, I was going to say, I forgot to mention, very, very important, the internet and computer setup in the unit, which also applies to houses. Do you want me to quickly cover that?
Sure, of course.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So I only have one device that I use, which is my laptop. I don't use my phone. My phone is on airplane mode in a Faraday bag all of the time, except if I need to make a call, which is very occasional. So I have, you know, messaging and everything on my computer, which is better for your eyesight and everything as well. So that's one less thing to think about. So I have one device, and that means I can have a dongle. And actually, if I had more than one device, you could have a splitter on it. So I have a 4G dongle, but I don't want that on my computer, even though my computer is about 25 inches from me, because it's going to create a big field. And even with my devices, I don't have to have it, therefore I'm not going to have it. So I have it on the end of a 5-meter extension, which is the longest length you can have it on and it will still work connected to your computer. And I put it out through the door and it's on a stick 5 meters away from me outside. So that's how I have internet access. And I've had brilliant internet access everywhere, including the most part remote parts of, you know, Ireland and the UK. So that's important. And then nothing is wireless and no Bluetooth. So keyboard, speaker, mouse, everything is hardwired to the computer. So I'm not creating even more electrical fields. So all of that is just really easy to do. It's not a big deal. You don't have to go without. It's just doing it slightly differently.
Well, you'd have to come to my studio and burn the place down and start over again with all that you got going on there. So I was going to bring out earlier, just to sort of illustrate your point. There's been research that shows people that live close to those big electrical towers. I don't know if you have them over there, but the big electrical towers, the metal ones, were all like a bunch of wires come together. And the people that live in proximity of those, it's been shown that if I had higher cancer, you know, instances of cancer and, you know, malignant cells and stuff because of those type of diseases, because of their proximity to those giant towers, those electrical towers.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's over 2,000 peer-reviewed studies on the harms of EMF. That's a whole other discussion. Do you, Corrie, you were starting to go into the conversation about campsites, and that's something I can say something about, and also planning journeys. I've got some good some examples of what I do there. Shall I cover that?
Sure.
Okay, right. Campsites. There are very few in the UK and Ireland that can take a unit of this size. And it's not, you know, in the summer when there's grass and the grass is hard, you can go on the grass, that's fine. Nobody wants you on their grass when the ground is soft. So what people don't appreciate with an RV is that you can't unhitch it and use your mover to just have it go on the pitch itself. Have you seen movers? You know what they are?
Is that where they crank the thing in the back and they lift the thing up on the
risers? No. Most caravans in the UK are boxes. They're not very appealing, but they're boxes, and they unhitch them and they put this thing underneath the caravan and they have like a remote control and it parks itself.
I don't think
it's
I've
incredible,
seen
that really. I mean, it's incredible. No. So that means they can go on any. They can get round any corner. They can go on a, you know, tight angle. Normally you've got pitches at right angles to the main track that goes along the middle. And so it doesn't matter because they can unhitch and they just put it on, you know, remotely. However, with mine, when it's 12 and a half meters hitched, I have to reverse, you know, it's all manual. So I have to have a big enough sweep. It's not going to go onto it's not going to park on a right angle. I have to have a big enough sweep to get me on the pitch. So I'm always going to look at Google Earth to see what the campsite looks like, look at their site maps if they've got one on the internet, phone them up and send them pictures. They don't like the fact usually the door is on the right. That's continental. You've got to take account of how close you are to your neighbor when you have a slide out. So actually, by the time you've done all that, and if you don't want to have kids around, you want to go to an adult-only site, and you don't want to be on tiny lanes getting to the site, you can't be too far off the main drag with a unit this big, then there's a lot of thinking through and asking of questions. And even having done that, I've had some hideous experiences. I'll tell you one, because I still sort of quake when I think about it. I was in Scotland and I was staying on a small site, as it happened on that particular occasion. It was in a village slightly off the beaten track, but I'd Google Earth the road. I could see from a street view. I could just about manage it. And I'd spoken to the guy and I'd looked at his access from the street view of Google Earth. And I said, well, it looks a little bit narrow. Oh, no problems. We've had articulates. We've had this. We've had that when we built the site. It's all fine. So I get there and I find there's two high walls, one on each side because they're houses, and it's like a zigzag. So I've got to negotiate this zigzaggy thing with high walls on both sides. And I have perhaps a millimeter of space on both sides of the unit. I'm absolutely dripping with sweat by the time I get in. And I spent the whole week panicking about how I'm going to get back out. And actually, I used, you know, my show jumping sort of technique of walking the course, Corrie. So I went out several times during the week and I walked my line exactly. I swung round and I sort of looked at where I was heading for and I tried to imagine how long it was. And actually, in the end, I did manage to get out okay. But again, I had a millimeter on each side. And I was shaking by the time I got out. And I said to the guy, you really cannot have a unit this big on, because if I'd got stuck, there is no way I'd have got out of the car, let alone maneuvered my way out of it or unhitched. You'd have had to take your house down, or I'd have had to get my unit dismantled, because it wouldn't come out otherwise. And so, with the best will in the world, you do make mistakes. But there you go. I survived. So
Quick
that was
story. I
all.
used to drive a limousine many years ago. I drove these long, long limousines and limo buses, and I had a similar situation where I got caught in, and I just had, I mean, no room. And I was, like you said, I was just sweating when I got finished, because I thought for sure I was going to take someone's mirror off or something like that. Anyway, that is a harrowing experience. I can kind of relate.
Yeah. Okay. So journey planning. Here's the thing. I've had other harrowing experiences relying on sat nav. You can have a road closure, and then it's going to take you off piste, and you find you're on a single track road on a flipping mountain going through a forest, and it's no good. So what I do now is that I look on sat nav, and I plan it all on the computer, and I have a look, and I have a map, and I've superimposed my route. Having looked at street views, if I have any doubt about the road, I spot check street views to see what it actually looks like on the ground. I look at the access into the campsites, as I said before, and so on. So I then have my map, and it's got stickers on all the pages I have to flip over as I'm traveling, and markers showing when I'm coming off a road on, turning off onto another road. And I have written instructions. So if one system fails, or it doesn't look like on the ground what it looks like on the computer, I've got different options. So I'm driving along, sort of trying to drive and stay on the road, and actually decide, what's going to be the most helpful navigation out of my three choices. So yeah, it's you should plan
You have tricky
extensively.
roads there.
Oh my God, Ireland. I mean, the roads are just chronic. You can go on a sort of main road, and you think it's like an A road in the UK, which would be a good quality road. And it goes from being tarmac to virtually unmade with no warning whatsoever. And it was so bumpy on my last journey here that my bike was hitting the ground. It was on the rack on the back, and the woman behind me is peeping a horn. And I get out and see what's going on, and I have to work out how to take off the front wheel on the side of the road, which I hadn't done before, but it's okay, it survived. So yeah, I mean, you just have to roll with it to a point as well, and stay calm. And I tell you one more story, because this was hysterical in retrospect, but so frightening at the time. I had a 3-day training course when I finished when the unit was finished and ready for me to take. And it didn't cover anything like what I really needed to know in hindsight. So I'm now in Scotland, and I'm coming down a pass between two lochs, and there's a massive drop on one side, and my brakes fail.
Oh man,
Yeah, they
not good.
basically, no, they were snatching on the unit, on the RV, and they were snatching and holding for about 4 seconds and dragging the truck across the road.
Oh.
So I'm like, I mean, I was, yeah, beside myself. So I managed to hobble to a local garage, and they couldn't help me. And I'm now on the roadside phoning the manufacturer. I'm on the phone to them quite often, as you can imagine, and said, well, this has gone on, and and have you seen it before, and what do I do, and what is it? And they said, oh yeah, that's just the brake brain. And I'm like, oh, what? The brake brain? How come that wasn't in the training? And it turned out that after 1,000 kilometers, you might have to adjust your brakes. So I'm lying underneath the thing, looking for the brake brain that I'd never seen before, having to make a manual adjustment, and then drive a mile down the road and adjust it again about four times, till I got to the point that it had enough brake in it, but it wasn't snatching. So yeah, you have to stay calm, and you just have to.
Well, thank God you were able to do that, though.
Yeah,
That's
no kidding.
pretty savvy, and not have to find, because that's another problem is, even over here, if you've got more so like with motorhomes than a travel trailer, but if something goes wrong with it, you have to find a place that's used to working on those. You can't just go into any auto shop.
No,
So
that's
that's
right.
kind of cool, actually. I mean, a little bit of a
Yeah.
pain, but.
Yeah, and actually, I wanted to talk about this thing about asking questions, the right questions. This takes us back a little bit in the conversation, but it is important. When I first went into the financial sector, it was totally alien to me, and I just didn't understand it. It was full of jargon and all the rest. And the only reason I got by was because I started to ask what seemed like really silly questions, and I was embarrassed to be asking them. But I asked these questions and I kept asking them until I got an answer in plain English that I understood. And that was how I built my ability to communicate what financial planning was all about to other people. Now, I've used that skill in every project I've ever done in my life, because every project for me has been a blank sheet and has been alien territory. And I think with this type of life as well, I've had loads of things go wrong. And you, when you're at a distance from the manufacturer and you can't get back there, and there's no one else that can help you, you have to use your nous to try and work out, well, you know, could it be this? Could it be that? And then you start asking questions. And then hopefully, if you ask enough questions, you have this dialogue going on, and they say, go and try this, and then you try that, and they say, try something else. Eventually, you sort of get there. But you do have to have some sort of nous to actually feel, well, you know, what's it linked to, and why would it do that? And then start asking the questions.
Right, absolutely.
Sorry, Corey.
What?
And there's
I
more. Yes,
know
sorry.
we're hitting our hour mark, but I wanted to just real quickly go over the Earthship community that you're looking at doing right now, which is your next manifestation. If I know James has someone coming in soon, so if we can touch on that
He should be here in
quickly,
about
that would
10
be.
minutes. So we got about 10 minutes, I think, before he's going to be here.
Yeah,
Okay, great.
okay. Right. Well, the Earthship manifestation. I mean, it was this thing about moving towards living in a self-sufficient way, being out of the system, and so on and so on. But actually, it was also about the fact that it's harder and harder in the world that we're in, which is so toxic, to achieve a state of what I call homeostasis. So homeostasis is where you are of sufficient balance and energy that your health isn't an issue, that you can actually get on and live your life. So most buildings even do not support homeostasis. They actually work against us because of their shape, because of their geopathic stress in the ground that the building's on, because of the electromagnetics and so on. So I thought, okay, I need to do something that is completely no bills, sustainable, ecological, and health-giving. And this comes from bits of research I've done over the years that I've managed to pull together in this current project. So the Earthship idea, this is actually a hybrid. It's another iteration, Corey, of the Earthship, because it's specifically designed for cold climates, but also it incorporates sacred geometry and biomimicry and natural physics and ways of creating heat and filtering your water and doing all sorts of things that is what nature does. So when you have the Earthship idea where you're partially underground, you're partially on top of the ground, you have the thermal mass from the heat from the thermal mass, the earth that's behind the building, that comes through the wall if the temperature inside drops below the temperature that is held within the earth. So that's how you bring heat in from the earth. Then you have solar gain that comes in from the glass that's on the front bit that comes out of the ground. You have the energy of the earth. You have the connection with the sky and the light. So you have a balance of elements and ingredients in that sense at a sort of spiritual level as well. But you can do amazing things. There's a guy in France called Jean Payne who created this system of bringing heat out of composting. So he created this compost heat. He put pipes and wires through it. He heated his whole house with hot water. I mean, it lasted for months and months until it was all decomposed and he had to redo the compost. But I mean, things like that, you can have underfloor heating with a furnace, a very efficient furnace that actually powers it, or a sauna that powers it, or a Russian oven, which is a sort of brick-built oven that can do all of the above. So I don't know. I mean, I just want, and I'm still exploring and developing and working out how you, what natural materials and aircrete and adobe, which is using the earth, and creating sandbags and anyway, there's a million and one different facets to it, and it's still very much a sort of a work in progress. Even thinking it through, I'm at that stage where I'm information gathering. It's wide open. I can't pin it down and make a plan yet as to a stage plan because I don't have enough information. But yeah, I want to do that. And also I want to stop being a hermit and I want to live in community with like-minded people. And that's very much into the whole sort of Aquarius energy of our times, collaborations of people with all sorts of different projects, not just living arrangements, but, making a stand over the judicial system or the EMF masts or whatever it is. But acting in community and the power of the community of like-minded people. So yeah, it's going to be all of those things. And I feel Ireland is the place to do it. It has a very special energy here. Actually, if we had time, I could tell you about the energy here, which is really incredible, but that's possibly another story.
Well, I don't know if Vegas is taking bets, Fiona, but I'm betting on you. I'm putting my money on you to be able to make this
Right.
work, right? I mean,
Right.
that's what you've been able to do, and I think it's, I you really the epitome of if you put your mind to it, you can do it. I mean, I think that's almost, what you believe you can achieve. That's probably your t-shirt, I think.
Absolutely. There are solutions to all things, and we have the power to manifest our own reality. And so I absolutely endeavor to walk my talk every day in that regard.
Fiona, what a fascinating interview. Good times. It was great to have you here. Corey, is there anything that you want to say or anything you didn't get a chance to say here during the interview that
Oh
we want to?
gosh, we could go on for 2 more hours
No, I
on this.
know. We
We could
probably
do a
could.
whole thing just on the Earth ships.
Yeah.
I'll have to have you on my podcast when you get closer to that stage because I did research into pyramids at one point. I told you about, I actually talked with an architect and started designing this, and there's studies that show just the healing abilities, the longevity, where they actually tested you could put grapes on counters and it could be there for weeks before it would even shrivel and it would never mold. And like razor blades would never dull. And so there's the geometry to it. There is a science to all of this.
It's like the
So isn't
golden
that
ratio. Isn't it the golden ratio? Doesn't it have something to do with it? I know
it's
that's
the
got.
golden ratio, that's
Yeah.
biogeometry. There's massive science behind biogeometry and the effects on healing. And the father of biogeometry is a guy called Ibrahim Karim, who's an Egyptian Egyptologist, and his books are absolutely astonishing. So yeah, I want to incorporate all of that because that's for nothing if you can get it right.
Absolutely. Well,
Fascinating
thank you
stuff. Yeah, we're
so
just out of
much.
time.
This was
Sorry,
great.
if you this is great stuff. And yeah, I'll have to have you on my podcast as well. Folks, we're just at the end of the podcast here, the Solution Series. We really appreciate you joining us here. If you want to find out more about what we've got going on, you can go to solari.com or coreysdigs.com and find out about the Solution Series there. A lot of great guests, including this one. And this Fiona's going to fit right in with all the other great guests that we've had. And again, we do appreciate you looking in here. And until next time, this is James White for the Solution Series, saying bye now.